Welcome back to the Dr. Dearen podcast. Today's episode is a really special one. I really enjoyed speaking with Krista Costello of BRCA Ireland. Krista really bravely shares her story with the BRCA gene mutation. She shares how it all started with her mum's cancer diagnosis, and then she discusses her own diagnosis and surgeries that she had. This is a really inspirational and special episode. I hope you enjoy listening today. Krista, I really wanted to talk to you more about your story and your experience with the BRCA gene and with the surgery that you had. But your story really started when your mom was diagnosed, is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I suppose it probably really started even before then, when my grandmother died of ovarian cancer and her sister died of breast cancer. And they were both diagnosed in their early 40s, but that was at the very start of the 90s. So BRCA kind of didn't really exist back then. And then when it did, you know, like we did hear stories about it. They discovered this kind of breast cancer gene and, you know, it was connected to ovarian cancer. And we did have discussions about it in our family and we mentioned it to our GP. And, you know, in the years following, you know, they ask at different appointments, your family medical history. And we would always mention it and we'd always get your grand, like you definitely don't have it. Genetic testing was never mentioned to us at all. So we just kind of got on with it then until my mum was diagnosed in 2019 with ovarian cancer. She's the eldest girl and kind of her mother was the eldest as well. And it's not a very large family. So at that time, there wasn't a lot of people kind of who had cancer. And even when before she was diagnosed, she repeatedly went to her GP with symptoms. And I suppose she was kind of going down the route of maybe some like bowel issues, IBS and stuff like that, because GPs were just not taking her seriously at all, kind of sending her home with laxatives and, you know, telling her to change her diet. And she even booked herself into like an intense boot camp thinking she needed to just lose that little bit of weight around like her stomach that she was gaining.
I mean, that's such an important message. You know what I mean? That is so important because there are so many women with these symptoms. And, you know, we hear time and time again, and sorry to interrupt, but that is so important that, you know, like not taking bloating seriously or constipation and thinking that you like need to lose weight or go to a boot camp. And actually very sadly as well, symptoms not being investigated or taken seriously by GPs as well, or, you know, doctors or healthcare professionals, and bloating, abdominal bloating or bowel changes, look, it might turn out to be nothing, but, you know, at minimum, you know, you can do an ultrasound. So that's just such an important message. And you know, that theme has come up a lot, I think, you know, quite a bit in the ISCO podcast, you know, this thing of like the importance of those non-specific symptoms of ovarian cancer. And look, we talk about BEAT all the time. So BEAT, bloating, eating changes, abdominal pain and toilet changes is really important. Sorry to interrupt, but that's just such a key message, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's kind of nearly a little bit harder because she was kind of proactive and she did keep going back and she kept going back to the GP and she kept, you know, like it must have been in the back of her mind, ovarian cancer, because she kept kind of saying, you know, my family history, my mother died of ovarian cancer, and she just wasn't taken seriously at all. She ended up going to A&E, and by that point, she was really sick. Like she had very, very advanced cancer at that point. So it was really kind of shocking the way we kind of put our fate in the doctors, thinking they would know all this. These are the doctors. These would know signs of ovarian cancer. You know, they would know that and they would send her for these tests. But she was just dismissed time and time again, like until it was at a point where there wasn't really anything they could do. And the type of cancer she had as well was quite aggressive. So it was only a short period of time. It was only like maybe 4 months. So, that was a bit crazy, really, like.
That's really upsetting to hear. And, you know, just a really important message. you know, but as you say, it's even more upsetting. You know, your mom was saying there's something wrong, you know. And look, for me here sitting as a GP, you know, a reminder as well, you know, just to investigate those symptoms, you know, just because I know for me as a GP, it's you know, it's easy to organise an ultrasound, you know, at very minimum. What age was your mom?
She was 57.
That's so young.
Mm.
Yeah. And then, so it was it around that time then, did your mom say to the doctors who were managing her care in the hospital, did your mom say, I need to get tested? Or did they say, we will test you for BRCA? How did that happen?
No, she kept pushing for it. She kept saying, you know, my mom had this and her sister had died of breast cancer, and she was responding to treatment exactly the way a person who had BRCA would. Okay. And she kept pushing it. And it was really strange that they didn't kind of say, look, we'll test you for this, because her diagnosis, whether she had BRCA or not, would dictate her treatment.
Yes.
So
yeah,
that was just crazy that they didn't. She kind of had to push. And eventually they entered her into the BRCA T trial.
Mm.
And that's where she got her results. But they took quite a long time to come back. And COVID was kind of happening as well. So that just kind of added extra time onto everything, and extra craziness and extra uncertainty. Mm. And actually a very wise person told me that COVID is very like having BRCA or any other hereditary cancer gene, because if you remember how you felt in that first year of COVID, there was just lots of uncertainty. There was lots of kind of waiting around to get this thing that may or may not kill you. And then you're getting all this different conflicting information. So that's kind of what it's like for us. But obviously it doesn't go away. You just, it just kind of keeps going and going. And then more information comes out and there's more tests and there's more treatments, which is a good thing. But it's kind of like always there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always there in the background. Mm. So then your mum then was diagnosed as having the BRCA gene mutation. BRCA1?
BRCA1, yeah.
Okay, because there's two, isn't there? There's BRCA1 and BRCA2. So do you remember that moment? Like, had you heard of BRCA before? What was going through your mind when you heard that?
We kind of heard it I think it was like the mid to late 90s. So it was kind of like a little conversation we'd always had.
Okay.
So we did know about it. We didn't know like a massive amount of it, but obviously when my mom got cancer, I kind of brushed up on it. I was kind of researching and kind of trying to find out as much as I could about it. So we did kind of know a bit about it.
Yeah.
And when she was diagnosed with it, they were kind of like, oh, you'll need to get like your breast removed. And she was kind of like, I'm actually, you know, terminal cancer. I've already got a slit from my rib cage down to my pubic bone. It's not really high up on my list of things to do is to go and get that operation. So I found like the communication kind of across departments, it's very lacking in hospitals.
Yeah. So your experience has been that there's been a real lack of like joined up thinking and, you know, I guess from the medical profession, a real understanding about this, about testing and the priorities for the patient. As you say, your mom is there, you know, fighting for her life with ovarian cancer. She's not thinking about a prophylactic mastectomy.
Yeah, she's like, she just didn't care about any of the rest of it. She was just very focused on getting us tested. So she did keep fighting for me to get, and I actually got my test really quickly, and I am the exception. Okay. And it's purely because of her pushing and just speaking up and asking about it. And she's quite like a cheeky character in any way. So she was like, you know, I'm gonna use this. I'm gonna just kind of say to them, I'm holding on now until my daughters get tested to see what she could do. Like, and my sister, she lives in Jersey, and she actually got her test even before me. And I was put on like an urgent waiting list. So it would kind of, with her being over there, I was able to kind of really see how slow everything is in Ireland and how different our treatment is. And yeah, it's worlds apart compared to the NHS.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just so like for you getting tested, okay, if anybody's listening and they're thinking, I want to get tested, were you tested in the context of like, say, your mum's care? You were kind of brought into that situation. So, and what was that? Did you go for a blood test with your GP or a saliva test with a nurse? What did you do?
So I actually went into St. James's Hospital.
Okay.
That was the hospital my mum was in. It was where she was, well, she got her BRCA T results then.
Okay.
So she, so they had like a family number.
Okay.
My GP had to send a referral in, but I had that kind of done really quickly. Mm. And then we kind of pushed and I got it done. Actually wasn't waiting a massive amount of time. I think it was about 5 months, which the waiting list is 2 years plus, because I have cousins and stuff that have been waiting 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite long. So for me to get it was amazing. It was all my mom's kind of pushing. So I went in, I had my genetic counselling appointment.
Okay.
And on the day of having the genetic counselling appointment, I had my blood test. But I suppose beforehand, I had done all my research. I knew exactly what I was doing. I knew I was having the preventative surgeries. You know, I'd finished my family. I'd seen everything my mum had gone through. And I was just like, I'm not doing the surveillance route. I'm not waiting to get cancer. I just need, you know, I just need to get this done. I just need to get it done really, really quickly. I suppose naively, I thought once I got the surgeries done, that would be it. Mm. And I kind of went, you know, like with everything my mum went through, it was just cancer. It seemed like forever. So I was kind of like, I'll get this done. I'll try and get this done really quickly. And then I'll just get on with my life. Mm. So I was quite naive about that in a sense.
Yeah. Okay. So you had the test. Then you found out you were a BRCA1 BRCA1 mutation carrier. So then you had the genetic counselling. So they went through with you then all of the statistics and, you know, I guess as well where you're at in your life, what surgeries you may or may not want to have. How long was that consultation? I imagine that was a long one, was it?
You know, it probably wasn't as long as, say, like my daughter. She had one, and her obviously would be a lot more in depth because she's younger. She's like, for me, I kind of went in and it was like, I know what I'm doing.
You had read up a lot.
I kind of went in and
you were prepared,
dictated it, and I was just like, let's get this over and done with. You know, I know what I'm doing. Sign me up into the family risk clinic and just like give me the blood test. I'm out the door. They were brilliant though. They were really nice, and then, you know, even after they gave me the results, I chose to get them over the phone because obviously it was COVID at the time. And, you know, they gave me a follow-up call afterwards as well. And, I can't say enough good things about them. They were really, really great.
Yeah.
They really looked after me. And I suppose even when they gave me the results, it was kind of like nearly a relief when they did, because I was waiting 12 weeks for them results. And for that 12 weeks, just felt like my life was on pause. So, because I had a plan to have the surgeries and have everything else. So I just was kind of like waiting to then enact that plan. So it nearly came as a relief when they did call me and I could just go, right, okay, move on to the next part.
Okay. So we'll get on to that part next. But, you know, like your mom was such a powerful and strong woman and advocated for herself and advocated for you and for your family. You know, if somebody is listening and they're thinking, and maybe they might not have that confidence to advocate for themselves in the same way, you are involved in BRCA Ireland, isn't it? And that's a support group for people with the diagnosis.
Yeah, I suppose support group is probably not the right word. We don't really know what we are at the moment. Okay. It's just a group of like-minded women that are.
Yeah.
We really saw that there's like a gap.
Yeah.
There's a gap between, like, you know, the medical professionals we're kind of speaking to are all like, you know, the system is not great. We need to change it. And we feel the same. So it's kind of like we're collaborating with whoever we can just to move forward and to make that change in the system. And then obviously we do direct people that contact us to services like Marie Keaton.
Okay.
They have the BRCA peer-to-peer. I'm also a BRCA peer support as well.
And
then ARC as well, do counselling and stuff. So we would kind of like try and answer as many questions as we can. Obviously, we're not medical professionals, yeah. So we're just like...
Signposting.
Yeah, yeah, signposting, okay. And kind of giving people information.
That's really interesting. Another thing that I found really interesting when I was talking to you on the other Is Go podcast, and just something that left a really lasting impression on me. And like, when you think of it, like I'm, you know, like I've studied BRCA gene mutations and, you know, the cancers and the genetics, and, you know, I do all of the book reading and I hear about it and all of that. But the actual practicalities of it had never really actually properly crossed my mind. And you mentioned about going on to Facebook to try to find family members, and that was such an eye-opening moment for me, because I never thought, oh my gosh, yeah, you start thinking of your wider family. So kind of what stage in the process did you start kind of reaching out to, or trying to reach out to others?
Yeah, so I suppose like my journey was quite, you know, kind of quite close to after my mom passed. So she passed in the October. I did my genetic counselling appointment in the December, and then I got my results in the February, and then within a month I'd had my first surgery. Mm. So it was after that surgery, because I kind of didn't have really a chance to nearly think about it beforehand. It was kind of when there was a bit of a lull that I was like, okay, my mom has cousins, don't really know a lot about them, but I need to find them. I need to find them. I need to tell them about this. Like, yeah. I know there was a few of them were girl. There was kind of like a mix of girl and boys, but I didn't know any of them. They'd all kind of been scattered abroad, like Australia and England and around the place. I'd never met any of them. I didn't know any of them. So I was just kind of, I was nearly like interviewing my mom's brothers and sisters, kind yeah. of going and getting as much information as I can. And one of my aunties was like, oh, I'm friends with one of them on Facebook. So I was like, okay, give me all the information. And then I wrote out a big long message and was like, this yeah. is our family number, you know, giving them as much information as you can. You can call me, you can message me back if you have any questions. And like, I messaged, I think I was getting to like number 8. I was kind of like doing one a day. I was psyching myself up and then refining the message to make sure it sounded less crazy. Because I was like, these are going to think I'm a scammer or I'm crazy. Like, or looking, you know, looking for money. Like, so I was like, I've no idea what way this is being yeah, received. Like, yeah. And nobody was answering me back. So I was like, God, what's going on? And then I got through to one of them who answered me back and were like, yeah, no, thanks for letting us know. Yeah, we know about this. So I was like, wait, wow. What? Like, God, what's going on? We don't know how it didn't filter back to our family. I hope it's just an oversight. Like, there was never any falling out. It was just they weren't like massively sure. close yeah. because obviously they're living in different countries. And I think, you know, once they'd kind of gotten it from the results from Australia over near us, I think they probably thought that the information would filter down, and it just never did. Like,
yeah. I mean, again, just a really, really interesting insight that, you know, I mean, you're so proactive and you're thinking, you know, this is something that runs in the family and I need to tell other family members, but other people aren't thinking that way.
I have heard stories back from other people who, like, say their cousin would have had breast cancer, then didn't tell them. And then they kind of went on to get breast cancer. So, you know, yeah. I don't think my story is very unique.
Yes.
And yeah. the kind of protocol is it's up to you to tell people. You know, having this information really does save your life. I mean, yeah. that person who was routinely tested in another country, you know, she was able to have her preventative surgeries and she's absolutely fine now. But my mum, who didn't have that information, like yeah. she's not here today. So it just kind of goes to show you it does save lives having this information.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, my mind is just really blown by your insights, because this is something that I never thought as well, either as a doctor, that, you know, we do very much just encourage patients just to tell family members, but maybe, you know, as you say, like, it's actually, it can be life and death for somebody, whether they know this or not, you know.
Yeah, and it's kind of received, like, I've heard from lots of different people how some families, it's nearly like this is like a dirty little secret.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Don't tell
yeah.
anybody. And, yeah. you know, like, there's people kind of going through their surgeries and it's like, oh, well, you yeah. know, we didn't tell Gran because she'd be very upset
yes,
about
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
And then that person kind of has to suffer on their own, and it's like hidden. And I suppose I'm so grateful that that didn't happen in my immediate family. Everybody's open about it. We all talk about it. We all share information. You know, even some of my uncles got tested, which it's quite hard to get men involved. Now, thankfully, like, most of them don't have it. But, you know, some families, it's just like the men don't want to be tested. Mm. And if they have children, then that's a really, like, it's a problem.
Yeah.
Because there's nowhere to go if your dad doesn't get tested on the line. You really don't have anywhere. You don't have any options because it kind of has to go in sequence of would be the father, and then it, you know, if he's on that line with it, and then if he's either, if he tests positive, then you can go get it done. But if that's not there, then you don't have any other options. Like,
it's fascinating. So it's really interesting. So really the message I'm hearing from you is we have a lack of services, we have a lack of infrastructure, we have a lack of education, we have a lack of specialist services really here in Ireland. And even your sister in Jersey through the NHS. So she, what was the process for your sister? Was she able to go to her GP and say, hey, this is happening in Ireland?
She just went straight to her GP with, I believe the genetics department emailed her a letter to give to her GP. So
okay.
The GP knew, had all the details, and she sent hers off. And I think she was waiting only maybe 8 weeks as well for her results.
Okay.
And it was all done really quickly. And then they, I think she had her ovaries removed kind of around the same time that I had my hysterectomy. But her care was completely different. Like, I was not, there wasn't spoken about HRT at all to me. Just wasn't spoken to me, and I didn't think to ask for it either. Like,
I have on some of my notes talked to you about menopause, and that, because that's something that I don't know if you Dr. Deirdre Lundy does a lot of so she does a lot of GP education, and I mean, she's saying, why are women not, at least are we not talking about it? That's really frustrating. I hope that we're doing better as medical professionals to have that conversation before the surgery, you know what I mean, and then after, and then again, and just keep revisiting it. Sorry to interrupt, but that's definitely a pet peeve.
It really is, because when you think about it, like, half the population are going to go through menopause.
I think more than half. I think there's
more
women.
Yeah. And we don't have enough information about it. Like, some GPs are still going off the very old, outdated, debunked study.
Yeah.
I still get a lot of kind of queries about why am you taking HRT? You know, you shouldn't be on that. Like, from medical professionals. So I am astounded, and I'm very frustrated by the lack of knowledge. When I experienced surgical menopause symptoms, which were insane, they hit me, like, I think maybe 3 days after the surgery, I had all of the symptoms all at once, and it was crazy. And I actually at one point thought that I had dementia. Like, the physical symptoms were bad, but the mental side really, really pushed me over the edge. I couldn't remember, like, words for, like, you know, fork, or I just couldn't formulate a sentence and then get it out my mouth. So I just felt nearly, like, trapped, and my emotions were, like, going from just sad to anger. It actually wasn't anger, it was intense rage. So I just felt like I just can't live like this. And it was my sister who had gotten information around her just before kind of her surgery about HRT, and she was like, you know, you should be on HRT. And I was like, my doctor's never mentioned that over here. So I was getting information from her. So I kind of then went to look for HRT, and my surgeon was like, oh, you can't take it because you have a BRCA. And my GP was like, no, you can't take it because you have a BRCA. And the family risk clinic were brilliant. They were like, yes, you definitely can take it, but we're nurses, so we can't prescribe it. So I was kind of left going, like, and at the time I had serious brain fog. I was really struggling to do anything.
You're recovering
from
surgery.
So I'm having to try and figure out how to get this. While I was literally running on maybe like two brain cells. It was ridiculous. So eventually, like, I did, I contacted the menopause hub.
Okay,
they
great.
Gave me, I actually seen something on Instagram.
Wow.
And I messaged them and they were like, oh, you definitely need to come into us. And Loretta was on like that.
No way.
Yeah, live. She was doing an Instagram live.
Yeah, yeah.
I messaged her and she was like, no, I'm going to get you an appointment straight away. And literally the next day I had an online consultation.
Wow.
And it was just, it was amazing. They had so much information. They knew like about BRCA.
Yes.
They knew about everything. They were like, prescribed me the HRT patches.
Yeah.
And they just like sent the prescription over to my GP or to my pharmacist. So like the next morning I was able to have that. And within an hour of taking it, I had this headache from like when I came around from surgery and it just didn't go. Like there was nothing taking this headache away. It was just always there. Within an hour of taking it, the headache was gone.
Wow.
And within like a couple, maybe half, like less than half a week, I was grand. Like absolutely grand.
That's incredible. Okay, there's so much to digest there in that you should have been counselled about menopause before the surgery, because then, I mean, if you started to experience symptoms, it probably wouldn't have been as distressing if you had known what this is. Whereas when you don't know what it is, like you said, you're thinking, am I getting dementia?
Yeah.
You know, and you wouldn't have thought to even reach out about HRT if it wasn't for your sister's experience. But then, and this is a message I get a lot on Instagram whenever I talk about menopause, is dear and GPs don't know about it, and they're, you know, they say I can't have it, they say it's too dangerous, they say I'm too old for it, they say I'm too young for it. But in that instance then, there are services, you know, like the Menopause Hub, and Loretta Dignam runs that. So you can reach out to a menopause specialist clinic like the Menopause Hub, and then there's Dr. Caoimhe Hartley is another menopause specialist as well that you can reach out to, her clinic, and they do online consultations. You can go to your GP in the first instance. I know, like in my experience, you know, there are GPs that are great in it, but look, if your GP isn't reading up on it, or it's not their thing, or you'd like more information, you can go to a specialist menopause online clinic like that, like the Menopause Hub and Dr. Caoimhe Hartley. They're and Dr. Deirdre Lundy. Their names are that are coming to the top of my head now as, you know, reliable, reputable doctors that you can get your specialist menopause care from. And then as well, I think it's really nice. It was nice to hear that, you know, that it was scrolling on Instagram that you reached out, because I think that sometimes, you know, social media gets a bad rap. But when it did provide you, I guess, with a bit of a lifeline or a connection to somebody you were looking, you think, God, these people might be able to help me. And they were. And sometimes you do need that specialist care, because you might have, you know, someone who's saying, no, you can't have HRT because you had because you have the BRCA gene mutation. But, you know, when you talk to the, you know, the specialist centres, they can give you that specialist care. So if there's, and again, another thing I'm really learning from you, Krista, is like the importance of, like, I see it's very, very hard, though. It's hard for patients to advocate for themselves, you know, but just reaching out as much as you can, or just talking to your sister, or just even like support groups, you know, even or like on your Instagram page, you know, you share so much information on the BRCA Ireland page. So reaching out, you know, is so important. So you had surgery. So the BRCA gene increases risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
So what cancers, what, so you had prophylactic surgeries.
Yeah.
Meaning preventative. So what surgeries did you have?
So I had a full hysterectomy. That's not always recommended for BRCA1. It was due to the gynecologist who I saw actually treated my mom, but also I was going to him for other symptoms beforehand.
Okay.
So it kind of just worked out nicely I had an appointment to get a smear test with him.
Okay.
Literally like a week after I got my results. So he was like, oh, so you have the gene. Okay, I'm going to look after you. And they just like booked me in.
Okay.
So within the like the month of getting my results, I had my first surgery done. Now that is like the exception. It kind of like doesn't happen like that at all.
You were linked in with this guy anyway. Okay, yeah. Okay, but that makes sense. So you had did you both ovaries removed as well? Okay, so you had both of your ovaries, I assume your tubes.
Yeah.
And your womb as well.
And my cervix. Okay, I didn't even know that was gone.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, actually, yeah, it makes sense to just get rid of the cervix as well, because it's just sitting there then just waiting to cause trouble.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So were you seeing the gynecologist just about like, you know, heavy bleeding or bleeding symptoms or?
I was kind of having symptoms. Like looking back now, I obviously was maybe starting the menopause because my periods had kind of stopped, but I was kind of getting vaginal atrophy, and that was my main issue, which that causes a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
So I was seeing him for that, and I suppose with my mom with ovarian cancer, you know, like while we were going through all that, cancer was like big, so obviously that's there in your mind as well. So I remember cheekily at one of my mom's appointments kind of saying to the nurse, listen, can I make an appointment, can I go see him? And she was like, I'm going to do that, but they put me in through to the Coombe hospital. So I think I was kind of like cutting corners and kind of getting exception where other people wouldn't normally do that. And it was purely because I was talking to people like.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking up for yourself, you know, I mean, you always advocating for yourself, speaking up, you know, and just asking the question, you know, that's, you know, nobody's, you know, going to have a problem with you asking question, advocating for yourself. So you had that surgery first. That's big surgery.
Yeah, I didn't really think that it was going to be a big surgery. I kind of thought that the breasts would have been a big surgery. So kind of then when I did go on to that surgery, it was nearly a relief because I was like, oh, okay, so the hysterectomy was the big surgery.
Yeah.
Because that took quite a while to get back. I think like it was kind of nearly a year before I was fully getting back to myself, where I wasn't like bending down to pick something up and going, oh, did I just move something in my stomach there?
Yes. And that's an important message as well, you know, that you are talking probably about, you know, a full year really of recovery there from, you know, big abdominal surgery like that. So then did you, how did you then get into the system then for breast surgery?
So the genetics clinic, they linked me into the family high risk clinic in James's. So I met with the nurses in there. It's run by nurse specialists, and it's a wonderful service. And they kind of have everything in the one space. So you will have your breast and your gynae appointments, and they do the surveillance as well. So I'm very privileged living in Dublin that I can avail of these services. So I had an appointment, but I kind of had done all my research, and like I have an autoimmune disease, so I kind of didn't really like the idea of implants.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to take that chance. I'm kind of like, if my body's already attacking itself, like, I don't know if they're, you know, going to accept having something foreign put into my body. Like, and for the, like, the DAP or the flap surgeries, I didn't have enough stomach fat. And I didn't really like the idea of having such a massive surgery. You know, kind of after having the ovaries removed and stuff like that, I kind of wanted something more simple with, like, kind of an easier recovery time. So I kind of had done my research and I'd found aesthetic flat closure. So I kind of went in with that. It wasn't something that was kind of offered to me. I was like, you know, this is what I'm doing. Yeah. This is what I want. And I suppose I kind of was a bit more proactive and more, you know, in line with advocating for myself because of my previous experience. Because I walked into that first surgery blind. I didn't ask any questions. Okay. I came out not knowing anything. And I kind of was like, okay, I can't do that again. So I nearly the next time I went in with a folder and my husband and questions wrote out. And, you know, like I had kind of done the work before that appointment.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's a really good way of tackling it, is write the questions, because you'll go into an appointment and your mind will just, you'll go into a blur and you'll forget to ask things that are actually keeping you up at night. So there was about a year between your surgeries.
No, that wasn't. I had my my hysterectomy in the March, and into September.
Okay.
I was really pushing. I was ringing them. I was on the phone going, can I have my appointment? Can I do this now? Can I do that now? Have you made this appointment? I was just constantly on the phone. I think I was nearly in autopilot. I think it was because it'd been so close to my mom dying, yes, I think I was using it as fuel to keep me kind of going.
Yeah.
So I was just, yeah, I think I probably just really annoyed the family risk nurse, because once I had their numbers and once I'd had that appointment, I was like, okay, right, I'm going to ring you. I'm going to speak to you. And I just kind of kept going until they were like, okay, let's make her an appointment. We're seeing this woman now. Like,
I'm sure they weren't. But do you think you were maybe running on a bit of adrenaline at the time?
Yeah. I was so focused to kind of go, I need to get this all over and done with so I can relax and not think about cancer. That's kind of what was fueling it. I felt like I had this, it's kind of like a ticking time bomb. I kind of was like, I'll just get this all done and then I can sit back and relax and get on with my life. Like,
okay, yeah, I understand your mindset. Yeah. And so then, I mean, once all, I suppose, the dust had settled, I mean, that's a really tough year for you, Krista, because you're a strong woman and, you know, your mom a strong woman. And you went through so much. That year sounds so hard. But you were running on adrenaline. How did it feel? How did you feel once everything had kind of maybe settled down a bit and you weren't on this mission kind of maybe as much anymore?
I suppose, I think that only really happened a while ago. I then kind of went into, I'll look for support. Where did we find it? Marie Keaton. And then I kind of got involved with them and became peer support and started doing kind of PPI studies and stuff like that. So I was kind of constantly on a track. I was just, I suppose I was probably distracting myself, but I think a lot of it was healthy distraction because I feel like it was beneficial. So I suppose I probably didn't really have that lull until probably recently. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I was privileged in that I was, because of like being the peer support and I've been involved with everything, I kind of knew what to do. I kind of knew where to go. I went back to my family risk nurse and I asked them for an appointment to see an oncology psychologist. So, and that was brilliant. And I had kind of during the journey had availed of like ARC. And I see a therapist as well.
Yeah.
So I'm all about therapy. I'm like, you can't do this without having somebody to talk to, because even though your family is going through it, they're all going through their own individual journeys. Yeah. Everything is very different. And, you know, like, and it is scary. Like, I suppose my eldest, she kind of recently tested negative. So we were absolutely delighted about that. But I was like mindful of talking about it in front of my kids, because I don't want to be kind of adding that extra pressure, or, you know, if they're not thinking about it, then bringing it to them and then they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
I suppose it is kind of tough. Like, so you do have to reach out and you do have to have that support.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an important message. And I say that quite a lot, you know, in terms of, you know, going to a therapist or going to a counsellor, because, yeah, of course, you know, you chit chat with friends and you love your family and they love you. And you can, of course, talk to them and confide in them. We all do that. However, if you needed to talk to your husband some evening that, you know, when you were going through it and you're worried about it, but equally he has his own journey of, I'm worried about Krista.
Yeah.
So that's what he's dealing with.
And that's the thing, is that if you go to kind of have this conversation with people, they naturally go, oh, don't worry about it, you're fine. So you can't really have that conversation, you know?
Because they're not in that mindset. They're just like, hey, I'm brushing my teeth, you know, and they need to get on with their day. So, you know what, it's nice. The thing that's nice about counselling or therapy or psychology is that that person is there to support you. And then that allows you to be just your wife with your husband, or your sister with your sister, or your daughter to your mum, that you don't have to use, if you, for want of a better word, use them as a counsellor. You go, you do your counselling, you do the hard work, and then you just get to be, you know, yourself then around family and friends a bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I found in the kind of early days, I kind of wasn't going to as many things because I kind of didn't want to be bringing it into the space, you know, because I would have a lot of family members that are still, they're still waiting on the results now, and some people that have tested positive, and, you know, so I kind of nearly felt like me going to these things is kind of, you know, bringing it, because of course they'd be like, how are you getting on after your surgery? Mm. And, you know, like, it is opening up that conversation. So I kind of felt like sometimes, oh, maybe I shouldn't go to this and I should just let people.
That's so sad.
Which, yeah, it didn't go on for like a very, very long time. But I just remember making the one or two choices gone, oh, I don't really, you know, want to be bringing the attention to bracket when this should be a happy event and everybody needs a break, you know.
Gosh, you know, that, and again, that's a really interesting insight into where your mind goes, you know, when you're going through an illness, those, you know, thoughts that you have that objectively, you know, obviously anybody would say, you know, they'd just be delighted to see you and delighted to see that you're doing well. But you're feeling like, oh, if I go, everybody will start thinking about this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of crazy, like, when you think about it. I'm delighted that I did have therapy at that point. To help me kind of see sense of it and then not do that anymore. But you kind of feel like you're in a weird space because I'm having these surgeries that are, like, they're huge. Like, I'm not having a lumpectomy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going through cancer treatment. I don't have cancer. But yet I'm going through these massive surgeries. But it feels like I'm in a limbo because there's no space. Because there, you know, there is a space for people if you have cancer. And, like, there should be. I'm not saying that. But it's kind of like you're in this no man's land where you're...
I'm not sick. I'm not a patient.
Yeah, but I've had these massive life-altering things happen to me and I'm still worried about, you know, getting cancer, passing it on to my kids. You know, it's sometimes it nearly feels kind of larger. And this is, it's not me saying it. I had a conversation with somebody who had breast cancer and she didn't have any genes or anything else. And she kind of went, you know, this is it for me now. Like, I'm in remission. I don't worry about getting cancer. I don't even worry about passing on to my kids. And I'm like, oh, well, I didn't have cancer. But yeah, I'm still worried about that kind of stuff. Like,
yeah.
So it's a very weird space to be in. And, you know, like, there are places out there, but they kind of advertise as being, like, counselling services for cancer. So I was very hesitant in even taking that step because you kind of feel like, oh, well, I don't deserve this because I didn't have cancer, you know. So it's a really strange space to kind of be in, and it's kind of great then when we do get together with other people who are in that same space, because we can kind of just talk about it or, you know, even joke about it, and just feel like there's somebody that actually understands this.
Sure, that you don't feel so alone going through it all, just completely by yourself. That there's other people, you know, who get it. You know, and have experienced, you know, the same story as you. So, I mean, your story, honestly, Krista, you're such an inspiring person, and you're such a strong person. And I think your podcast will be so useful to people listening. And if they want to, because you do share great information on Instagram. So you have two pages, don't you? You have your own page.
Yeah.
And so that's the Bracaflatty.
Yeah.
But is that it? BRC?
Bracaflatty.
Okay. Yeah. And
my therapist actually suggested that I share it on social media. And
really?
It was a good experience. Beforehand, I was not on social media at all.
Really?
I'm old.
Okay.
I don't know how to do it. Like, I hadn't a clue. Like, I literally had to learn how to go on Instagram. Yeah. And I just kind of was like, I don't mind sharing pictures because it's not very, you know, wide. And I found I connected with a lot of people going through similar stuff.
Yeah.
So it was actually a really good experience starting off and doing that. I got really positive feedback and, like, lots of people got in touch with me from all over the world that were experiencing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So that was, like, amazing. I'm really glad that I did that.
Yeah.
Which was, it was a massive step, but I kind of thought, listen, if I can get my breast cut off, I can do an Instagram page. Like,
absolutely, you can do anything.
Yeah.
And you have the Bracca Ireland page as well.
Yeah.
And that's a nice message as well. Again, look, social media gets a bad rap and there's a lot of bad parts of social media for sure. But the good part is it can create a sense of community. And then as well, it makes the world very small because, you know, you're probably connecting with people all over the world who get it just like you. You know, they've been through similar stories. So, you know, it can provide a support network
and you can get positive feedback, you know, that can be support, can provide support when you're going through something difficult, you know. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you want to talk about today, Krista, or to highlight?
I hope not. I think we probably covered.
Well, you know, I think if we achieved anything, you know, it's that, okay, yeah, we hear about BRCA gene and it's just kind of, we hear it and it's in passing and it's a word on a page. But what it really means, you know, to walk in the shoes of somebody who's had the diagnosis, and it's logistically very difficult. And look, as I said, if anybody's listening and they're concerned about it, you know, you can reach out to your GP. However, again, like, you know, as you said, in the medical profession, you know, we don't have the infrastructure or services really properly built up around all of this yet. Hopefully we will in time. But, you know, there are other resources as well online, like you said, like the peer support group from Marie Keating. Okay, thank you so much, Krista. It was a pleasure to talk to you. I've learned so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you.